This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
Dominic, there's a problem in my kitchen.
Have you found rotten potatoes again?
No. Thankfully, the rotten potatoes are a thing of the past. But I've got one of those Google Home devices that can, like, play the radio and set cooking timers and stuff. And my one has evidently decided that I am not getting into the Christmas spirit enough. Because listen to what happens when I try to play French radio.
Hey, Google. Play France Inter Radio.
Santa Party by Desmond Dennis, sure. Playing on Spotify.
That's horrible.
Can you believe that?
Wow, the Santa lobby is really working hard at Google.
I mean, to be honest, this Google Assistant has been undermining my authority for a while now. I noticed that when I request a song, he'll say, like, okay, in this dismissive kind of voice, like, you know, bad choice, but fine, I'll play it. But, like, forcing me to listen to Christmas music, this is a whole new level of rebellion. So if anyone who works for Google is listening to this, please do something. The robots are getting out of control.
Maybe we need to use this to our advantage and persuade the robots to start accidentally playing the Europeans podcast to everyone.
Yes, that's a very good way of engineering this. Let's make that happen, please, Google. What's coming up this week?
Well, we've got an animal-themed episode this week, which should hopefully be a bit of fun to cheer up these rather gloomy days in Europe.
I think we need it.
Yeah, we do need it. And we're going to be heading to the north of Europe today, to the region of Sápmi, to speak to a Sami reindeer herder and climate change expert, Jani Stefansson. We're in a time of year when fantastical imagery of flying reindeer is pretty much everywhere. But the reality of life for the reindeer that live in the north of Europe is an increasingly difficult and dangerous reality. Jani will be sharing her knowledge and experience with us later on in the show. But first, it's time for an animal-themed good week, bad week.
Oh, I don't know why I did a wolf there. There's no wolves coming. Spoiler alert. Who's had a bad week?
It's been a bad week for the Tuscan Archipelago National Park Authority in Italy after they received a barrage of criticism for an EU-funded biodiversity project called Let's Go Giglio on the small Tuscan island of Giglio. And criticism came because as part of this project, they invited hunters to the island for a culling of a rare type of wild sheep, the European mouflon.
Mouflon.
Mouflon. Do you know what it looks like, Katie?
No, I'm just Googling it. Oh, I've never seen a sheep that looks like that before. It looks like almost like a gazelle or something. Lovely horns.
Yeah, the male version of it has a really distinctive, almost fully circular horn. And it's got like short hair that's white and brown. It's quite nice looking, really.
So why are we culling these rare sheep? That seems kind of counterintuitive to cull rare sheep as part of a biodiversity initiative.
Yeah, well, I should start by saying mouflon are not a native species for this island. So they were brought there in the 1960s by a private landowner who originally kept them in a reserve until he abandoned it and the mouflon then escaped and their population's been getting bigger. Mm. There's quite a lot of confusion about the origin of mouflon on this island, but there's some suggestion that the reason why they were brought there was actually for the purposes of hunting. Although there's another theory that they were actually brought there for conservation purposes. So there's really no clarity. And even when I've seen the EU commissioner talking about it, he's not that clear on what's the truth. So I don't think I'm going to be able to get to the bottom of that in this good week, bad week. But yeah, you asked why they are being culled. And I'll quote this EU commissioner in my answer, the EU commissioner for the environment, who said earlier in the year that they've now found out that the sheep negatively affect the holm oak habitat on the island. So they considerably reduce the regrowth of these trees and other shrub species and drastically limit their growth.
Mm.
So the eradication of the sheep aims to address these impacts. And the local mayor said to The Guardian that he'd also received several complaints from farmers about damage to their land from these sheep and that their numbers were increasing.
Okay, so there's too many of them, apparently. But I'm still confused because you said they were rare. Like, what's the deal?
Yeah, it's kind of complicated to work out quite how rare they are. I'll give you a little background to this sheep. The European mouflon was originally only found on Sardinia and Corsica, two other islands, but they've subsequently spread to many other regions of Europe. They're a protected species on the islands of Sardinia and Corsica, as they were at some points actually endangered on those islands due to hunting and poaching. But now, thanks to hunting bans on both those islands, the populations there have been recovering over the past decades. There's also now pretty big populations in Central Europe, but we don't have an official conservation status for this subspecies from an international body that hands those out, simply because they are considered as feral populations of ancient domestic livestock, so they don't get their own little conservation status. So in answer to your question, they're not currently officially endangered, but specialists do describe them as rare.
Mm-hmm.
They are, however, not protected on the island of Giglio. So this hunting plan was not necessarily illegal. And as I said, the animals are not indigenous to this land. And it's not unheard of that there are some species of plant or animal that are rare or endangered in one part of the world, but invasive in another part of the world. So I know it's a difficult thing for us to get our heads around. Maybe it's not a difficult thing for us to get our heads around. But the hunting has anyway caused a big uproar from some locals and animal rights groups. They have been saying that it is actually illegal because there is a workable alternative to killing them. They say that the sheep could be moved to another national park in Tuscany, for example.
Right, that seems like a sensible idea. Can't we just move them?
Well, maybe we can. And this is where Bad Week nicely segues into Good Week for the mouflon, because it seems like the uproar and protests have worked. According to the local press, after meeting with the animal rights activists, the park authorities seem to have agreed to suspend the shooting program.
Oh, that's good.
It is good. Sadly, too late for a few of the mouflon who've already been killed, but a reprieve for the remaining mouflon who will hopefully now be moved, although there's still a lot that needs to be decided. And the park authorities point out that they are only going to be able to continue their dialogue with the animal rights groups if those groups agree to the objective that the mouflon actually have to leave the island, something that not all of them agree with. Some of them think, no, the mouflon exist here. It's not a problem. We need to deal with it. But I think it seems like a pretty good compromise and exactly what many of the activists were asking for. So maybe it's a good week all round. Surprise.
Oh, I was not expecting that. I've prepared a good week. Shall I just go home?
I actually wasn't expecting it either when I was researching. It was only when I found some local press with the latest news.
Very nice surprise. I'm very happy for all those cute little mouflons.
Me too. Who else has had a good week, Katie?
Yeah, well, I've got some more good animal news for you, which relates to the eruption of the Canary Islands volcano back in September. You probably saw pictures of this volcano erupting a few months ago on La Palma Island. It caused really devastating damage. Thousands of people's homes have been buried in ash, and loads of banana crops have been ruined, which is a massive blow to the local economy. It's been really, really heartbreaking for local people. And it's still going on. There is still lava spewing out of the top of the Cumbre Vieja volcano. I am getting to the more positive bit. It involves a local beekeeper called Antonio Quesado. Several weeks after the eruption, Antonio went back to check on some of his beehives in one of the villages that got destroyed. And to his amazement, tens of thousands of the bees that had been in these hives were still alive and like happily buzzing away. These hives have been completely covered by burning hot volcanic ash. It was the equivalent of like a red hot avalanche, really. But something like 50 days later, miraculously, these bees, canary black bees, they're called, they were still happy as Larry.
That is amazing. How did they survive? Like, are bees used to really high temperatures or something?
Well, no, that's not it. Antonio says that they managed to feed off the honey supplies that were in the hive already, which just goes to show that it pays to keep a nice full cupboard. The bees also make this really sticky mixture called propolis.
Yeah, you can buy that at like health stores. Isn't that something?
Really?
Yeah, you can buy a propolis supplement, I think.
Ah, well, it's also sometimes called bee glue. And the bees used that to seal themselves into the hive, which stopped the poisonous gases from the volcano from getting in. Kind of like a survival pod, I guess. But it's really good news on a couple of fronts. Firstly, because honey is actually quite an important industry in the Canary Islands, as well as being crucial for the ecosystem. So Antonio's discovery has brought hope that there maybe could be more beehives like this still surviving under the ash. But I was also reading an interview with Antonio in the New York Times about what a nice reminder this is of how amazing bees are as a species. He said, "It's incredible how such a tiny animal that has been around for hundreds of thousands of years can maintain that resilience, that ability to survive." And it's true that we often tend to forget how tough they are because of all the grim headlines about bees disappearing. The New York Times quoted a bee expert, Dr. Natalie Steinhauer, who said that even though it's quite well known that honeybees are pretty resilient, even she was surprised that these bees had just managed to hang on for like 7 weeks just feeding off their own honey supplies inside this self-sealed hive thing.
That is amazing. It reminds me of when the Notre Dame was on fire and the bees on the roof of the Notre Dame somehow survived as well.
Bees are amazing.
So it's the conclusion of this that we can just like stop worrying about bees. Like I'd love to have one less thing to worry about our sickly planet.
I know you would. And I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but no, I don't want to make it sound like we can stop worrying about bees because worldwide they have been dying at really frightening rates. But I just thought this was a really nice reminder of how amazing bees are. Also, it felt like an animal version of a couple of stories about humans this week getting snowed in by various snowstorms. Did you see the story about a Danish branch of IKEA?
Yes, I loved it. I wish I'd been there.
So amazing. About 30 people got trapped overnight in the IKEA in Aalborg, and they got to sleep in the display beds. And I know it was probably like quite stressful in some ways, but it also sounded really fun. The store manager, Peter Elmos, told the Extra Bladet newspaper that people got to pick out the bed that they've always wanted to try. And also apparently everyone spent the night watching TV and eating snacks. Lovely. Similarly, a pub in Yorkshire in Northern England got snowed in for 3 days last week. So they had a 3-day pub lock-in. The dream.
I think I'd rather get locked in IKEA than in a pub.
Well, probably this one, because these people have been there to watch an Oasis tribute band. So there was loads of music to keep people entertained, but knowing your music tastes, I'm not sure that's your idea of a good time.
Yeah, when I saw that story, I really thought this was my idea of hell. I actually just saw a really amazing photo from La Palma, not of bees, but of cats sitting on the ash. Did you see it?
Yeah, is this the one of all the cats? And they're sitting on the ash. And I assumed it was because the ash is like really warm and cozy. Is that what they're doing?
The photographer says that they were in search of food.
Oh.
Because, yeah, they were abandoned cats. So it's actually a really sad photo, but also quite extraordinary photography. So I've just retweeted on that on our account. Why don't you follow us on social media? Check us out on Twitter at Europeans Pod, Instagram at Europeans Podcast, Facebook, The Europeans Podcast, or check out our website, europeanspodcast.com.
In other good news, this podcast has a new supporter to thank. Who is it, Dominic?
Yes, huge thanks to Berit for joining our club. We could not still be making this show if it wasn't for our lovely supporters on a little website we like to call Patreon.
We do like to call it that.
We do. That's because it's what it's called. If you head to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast, you could also become a supporter of this podcast, which is otherwise and will remain totally free at the point of use. We want to keep making this show and bringing you stories of animals and humans from across the continent. So please consider it as a Christmas present for someone who likes the podcast, for yourself, or even for us.
We could buy ourselves a nice mouflon sheep with the proceeds. That's not what we're going to spend it on. We're going to spend it on paying our staff. Thank you so much to everyone who was keeping us going. Thanks to my Google Home Assistant, I am apparently being forced to get into the Christmassy spirit, whether I like it or not. But beyond that, now that it's December, We've actually been thinking a lot over here at The Europeans about the really wide range of Christmas traditions practiced around Europe, more on which next week. But this conversation got us talking about reindeer. Do you know, Dominic, when reindeer became associated with Christmas?
Was it Coca-Cola at the beginning of the last century?
It wasn't Coca-Cola, but it is quite corporate and it is American. The author Washington Irving brought in this idea of Santa Claus putting presents in some kind of flying wagon around 1812, but there was no mention yet of the reindeer. You do start getting references to reindeer putting the sleigh in the years that follow. But one person who really helped to commercialize this Christmassy reindeer association was an American businessman called Carl Lohman. He was in business around 1900, and at the time, reindeer meat and fur were just arriving as a growing industry in the US. So Lohman thought that doing some kind of Christmassy PR around this industry could help familiarize Americans with reindeer in general. He really wanted to turn reindeer into a staple meat in the US, like chicken or beef. Reindeer herding had actually arrived in the US through a group of immigrants that had come to Alaska. These herders were Sami people from Northern Europe who found the Alaskan landscape pretty familiar, so they were able to adapt pretty well to their new life there. And actually, in the first promotional Christmas parade that Lohman organized, he had several Sami herders join the parade in traditional dress next to their reindeer as part of this sort of corporate jamboree. So that is how Western capitalist society adjoined these ideas, Christmas and reindeer, a century ago. It was really part of a kind of promotional meat campaign. But of course, for the Sami people of Northern Europe, herding reindeer has never had anything to do with Christmas. It was a way of life for them then, and it remains a way of life for many Sami people now. This week, we wanted to travel to the very north of Europe to hear a little bit about what that way of life is like for people from this indigenous community. So we gave Janni Staffensson a call in Sapmi, in northern Sweden. Janni comes from a long line of Sami herders, and she continues to look after a herd with her partner. She's also a scientist by training, so she has a really unique perspective on the impact of climate change on this community whose life depends so much on weather patterns that have been undergoing really, really drastic changes in recent years. In general, Janni is also just someone who speaks really beautifully and powerfully about her community and its relationship with nature and the threats that their way of life are facing. Here she is. What is an average day like for you?
Oh, that depends on the season, the weather and the reindeers, climate change. It really, really depends. Right now, we have an active season of the reindeers coming down or being brought down from the summer areas, which are up in the mountains. And depending on Sami community, they will have a different time for them to get down to the winter areas where I am at now. So the last 3 days, we've had many gatherings with different communities and bringing down some of our reindeers that have wandered off to our neighboring communities. So now we have gathered some of those reindeers that have been in our neighboring community in a small fenced area, and we are supplementary feeding them there. I'm going there later on to check on them and to see that they are adjusting to this new feed, which is also a difficult task to manage. It's quite long days, heavy work, and long nights.
And could you tell us a bit about your relationship and your community's relationship with reindeer?
Yeah, so I'm Sami, the indigenous peoples of Europe and Scandinavia. Sapmi, our area is called, which is an area where Sami have been living. And it's in Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. I was brought up then in a reindeer herding family, and I live now with my husband in his reindeer herding family. Our reindeers, they're walking freely and migrating freely. We keep them only in fenced area if we really have to, when we are forced to do so by climate change. So during these difficult winters, we have been more often forced to keep them in fenced area, which is not very good for the reindeer because they don't have that immune system to be crowded. Their immune system, the best they have is to migrate, to leave the sickness behind. And if there is a sick individual of a reindeer, they usually push it out from the herd. But that's impossible to do when you keep them in fenced area. So it's super risky to do so, but we are forced to it.
You actually studied organic and environmental chemistry and you're now an expert in climate change. I'm wondering how you first sort of became aware of climate change. I mean, most of us who live in urban areas, we find out from school these days, but I imagine this is something that you could see in a very real way, even when you were a kid.
Yeah, we saw it and I heard about it when I was young from my father and when the grown-ups talked and the elders as well, always commenting on that the weather was changing and it was strange events. And now we see it on everyday basis, really. The last thing I saw was just 2 days ago where the male's antlers have been starting to grow about 2.5 months early, which we do not know what kind of effect that will have on that individual. But we know that when the antlers grow, they keep a lot of blood inside them and they're super sensitive. And if one of those antlers break at the growing stadium, the reindeer can bleed to death. So we do not know if there's going to be a lot of low degrees coming down and low temperatures. Will the antler freeze more and what will happen with the health of the reindeer? So those are just one of the recent climate change events we have spotted.
And you mentioned being forced to put them in some kind of fencing. What else are you able to do to help protect the reindeer from this myriad of threats?
For example, in the winter, we go out and see where is the best pasture and then lead them to that. So we have to work harder to find areas with good pasture. And for as long as we can, we try to keep them out of the fenced area. And sometimes we supplementary feed them outside as well. But it's difficult to keep them in the area when there's poor pasture. Then they will wander and wander and wander until they find good pasture. So it's difficult also to keep them as a herd. And sometimes if you feel that it's too high of a risk to keep them in a fenced area, you just have to leave them be and let them wander off. But that's also a risk because then some individuals might not be able to find some food, which it's up to us to really help them with that. But we can also help them when there's new diseases coming in, both due to climate change, but also due to new insects coming with new diseases. We try to help them regain health and learn about these new diseases and how to avoid them, how to see that they are sick. Because the reindeers, since they are in a herd, one of their prevention from not being eaten by predators is not showing that they are in pain or are weaker than any other individual. So they are experts on showing that they're not in pain. If they are in pain, they're not give you any sign of it.
That's heartbreaking that they've developed that.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
You spoke really passionately at the UN climate talks in 2015 about how the negotiations were frankly just ignoring Indigenous people. And it was really obvious to anyone who's watched that video just how infuriated you were by this. Have things got any better since then, do you think? Do you feel like the latest round of climate talks did any better at taking Indigenous people on the front lines of climate change into account?
No. No, they have not. And the state is the same as it was when back in 2015.
That's depressing. What should they be doing, these climate negotiators?
Well, they should be taking the actions that they need to do. And we all know what that actions is. There have been plenty IPCC reports. They have all the facts. They have all the research. But right now, the leaders are not, they don't want to take those difficult decisions that they need to do. And I think the only way for them to actually act on it is that the people need to rise up to the challenge and be more upfront with their politicians in what they have to do. Yeah, I think that's how we might get things to change, because there are catastrophes all over the world right now and we see them more and more, but the leaders are not acting. It's not to the lack of knowledge. It's not due to lack of science, or it's not due to the lack of facts or evidence.
I wanted to talk to you briefly about the role of reindeer in Western Christmas celebrations as kind of Santa's transport providers. How do you view this tradition? And do you think the increased interest around this time of year in reindeer could in some way help draw attention to the plight of these animals?
Yeah, maybe. I can hope that people feel for the reindeer because they are an animal of winter and they are designed to sustain really harsh conditions and Arctic conditions, low temperatures. But because of that, their fur is designed for low temperatures and not high. And the summer times right now is getting higher and higher temperatures, which is difficult for the reindeers because they're not designed to live through that. If people like reindeers more because of Santa's and this Christmas celebration, that is beneficial for the reindeer because they're amazing animals and amazing beings with great personalities. And they're super kind. It's a super kind being. And they're compassionate and they tend and care for each other. So there's a lot of learnings that people can get from reindeer.
And reindeer obviously hold a very different place in Sami culture than they do in this Western Christmas tradition. Can you tell us a little bit about the place that reindeer have in the Sami identity?
The Sami identity origins from the reindeer. So when God created the world, it made the rivers out of the reindeer's blood. It made the forest out of the fur from the reindeer. And it made the stars from the ice. The reindeer is what sustained us. If reindeer wasn't in Arctic in our areas, we wouldn't be able to live in this condition and have survived for thousands and thousands of years. Reindeer provides us with food and clothing and homes and transport. So we have an obligation to the reindeer to sustain it as well now when they are facing these challenges. They're family to us.
Speaking to Yanni is a really important reminder, I think, of just how drastically climate change is already affecting life on this continent. It isn't something that's happening elsewhere and is something that's going to happen in the future. It is happening here and it is happening now. Do follow Yanni on Instagram, where she documents her life as a reindeer herder in the Sami community. You can find her at Yanni Staffensen. The link is in the show notes.
This week, we have a special isolation inspiration with an interview with a maker of a lovely European cultural project to fill your perhaps increasingly isolated days, unfortunately. This is a show that has a lot of episodes. It's from the European culture channel Arte, and it's called Re-European Stories. They put out multiple episodes each week, which are all short documentary portraits of individual Europeans showing Europe in all its diversity.
It is a really fascinating series, available with subtitles in 6 languages. And yeah, we thought you'd like to hear more about it. So we invited its commissioning editor, Frederik Ulfertz, on for a little chat.
You're making a very broad series. It covers everything from gang warfare in Sweden to Italian rescue dogs. How did you go about choosing these stories?
Well, we have a lot of production companies working for us, and they have lots of producers all over Europe. They kind of propose themes to us or stories. We, in our editorial meetings, are also coming up with stories. So it's kind of a mix. And, you know, Europe is very diverse and there's always lots of things happening. So it's a broad source of stories.
But of the pictures that come in, is there something about those stories that makes you think, aha, okay, this is one that we definitely should do?
It's about the people. Normally, we should not have just a theme. It does need to have a story, a personal story. That's the main thing. And this personal story tells us something also about society. It has a kind of a relevance or is important for Europe in some way.
So you're not looking for specific themes, but have any themes accidentally emerged while you're making it?
Well, what really has emerged is Corona. So we were very busy with it. And I don't know, last year we made about like 40 episodes kind of related to Corona problems. We didn't have a pandemic before. This show is now running 5 years, and this was definitely new. The first one was actually on the development of the vaccine. It was in March last year. We had a very touching story about Spain when it was hit in the first wave. It was a very emotional and very touching story, but also about lots of people who are on the brink of losing their economic existence, about the people working in the hospitals. So that has many implications also on the farmers who couldn't get any workers anymore and stuff like that. It was lots of often very sad stories connected with it.
You've been making this series for about 5 years now. Has making it changed the way that you think about Europe?
Difficult question. I don't know. I'm now 52 years old and I've been to many places in Europe before. So I've seen a lot, but there's always surprises. So we are doing many things on Eastern Europe. I didn't know it that well. It was kind of the most surprising stories sometimes.
There are many, many episodes available now for people to tune in online. Could you tell us about one or two of your favorite episodes? A good place for people to start.
Good place to start is always the next episode, because like every day there's a new one coming. But my favorite episodes, very hard to tell. There's been one on kind of village shops in Germany, which was very nice because it went into the sociological group of these villagers was very nice. You have a very good insight of a small community.
I personally really enjoyed the episode. It was looking into tea farming, organic tea farming in Georgia. A really nice Lithuanian and Estonian couple who moved there to try and find a way to farm tea organically.
Oh yes, thank you.
It's the best way to be like in connection with the nature, actually. So you can actually, you see them growing like in the spring when they actually start to, like the first small ones start to grow. It's really like an amazing feeling.
Organic farming is a very big topic also. And it's very various and there are different circumstances. And this is very interesting to compare how the different countries are dealing with problems or challenges of the future. So we can also learn from each other.
How do you make sure that you are covering a diverse spectrum of the continent? Do you have like boxes to tick to make sure you're covering every corner or in every country? Or is it something that just seems to work out organically?
It does work out kind of well. But of course, we have to look at it when we do the planning or when we're like commissioning episodes. We have to look that we don't do like 5 pieces on Romania within a month or something like that. But since we have very broad base of producers and production companies, many producers are based in these countries. So it's a very diverse background we have.
Thank you to Frederick for speaking to us and to Arte for sponsoring this segment of Isolation Inspiration. There are dozens of fascinating episodes available from Arte with subtitles or dubbing in 6 languages. Check out the link in our show notes. Dinosaurs fit into an animal-themed episode, right?
Well, I recently learned that chickens are dinosaurs. So yeah, dinosaurs are animals.
Most birds are dinosaurs, right?
Yes. I feel like we should have a dinosaur expert on to talk about this. But yeah, let's go with yes.
Well, a team of paleontologists have found fossil remains of a whole herd of dinosaurs. 11 of them, including remains from one dinosaur, which is being described as the most complete and the biggest dinosaur ever found in Italy.
Wow.
They've named him Bruno, and he is part of the Tethyshadros insularis species, who lived 80 million years ago. Wow. I can't get over that. And could grow up to 5 meters in length.
That is amazing. Is this really like quite big on dinosaur discoveries? Like, I don't think I've heard of a case like this before.
No, it's actually not really known for dinosaur fossils. Although the former limestone quarry near Trieste, where the remains were found, is a site where other dino bits and bobs have been found in the past, but never on this scale. If you happen to live near Trieste, then you can take a peek at the dinosaurs at the Civic Museum of Natural History. Let us know if you go.
I'm really jealous of the person who got to name the dinosaur Bruno. Like, what a cool job.
Do you think it's someone's job to name dinosaurs?
Full-time gig.
Well, Katie, I think maybe we should change this podcast to being just an animal-themed podcast instead of a European podcast, because this has been fun. I like talking about dinosaurs and bumblebees a bit more than I like talking about Emmanuel Macron and Viktor Orban.
Let's do it. It makes a nice change.
We could talk about politicians as if they were animals.
Stalking through the undergrowth, the presidential candidate mounts the stage. Yeah, no, it's not going
to
happen.
Anyway, before we go, we've got a bit of exciting news to share with you. Do you remember our episode from a few weeks ago about Sara and her relationship with the Albanian savory porridge, Trahana, and what it meant to three generations of women in her family? Well, that episode has been reworked by a pretty huge American podcast with the help of our wonderful producer, Katz Laszlo. The podcast is just a little podcast called Rough Translation, one of the best podcasts in the whole of America. And you can hear their reworking of our Sara episode on this week's episode, which came out on the 8th of December yesterday. Go check it out and let us know what you think. We're very proud of Katz and of ourselves too, and of Sara.
So exciting. We will be back next week for our last episode of the year. We're planning a little party, everyone. There will be snacks.
This episode was produced by Katie Lee, my co-host, and Wojciech Oleksiak. We are part of the Are We Europe audio family, and you can check out their other audio offerings at the link in the show notes.
See you next week, everyone.
Ciao.
Bye.